I'm a university lecturer in geography. So for the last 25 years, I've taught 18, 19, 20-year-old students at university, and we get to spend about half our time doing research, sometimes doing admin, minority of our time teaching. So we're not necessarily that good at teaching, but we do get to play around with things. How many of you think you're going to go on to university, just so I get an idea? Put your hands up. Okay, so it's the majority. How many of you are going to go when you're 18? How many of you are going to go when you're 19? How many of you want to go later? Yeah, nobody thinks about going later. It's always worth thinking about. How many of you are going to go and do geography at university? Okay, that's a good number. Right, who's going to do economics? That's a good idea. Who's going to go and do English? Many. Sociology? And I guess business studies. What have I missed out?
Music.
Law. Anybody else?
Psychology,
okay. Right. University is obviously very different from school. If you go to a normal university, people don't keep much of a tab on you, so you can kind of do what you like, which sounds fine. Except you'd be amazed how knackered you get when you can do what you like, and how much you run out of money very quickly. University lecturers are allowed to make up what they teach you. There is no equivalent of A-levels or GCSEs. There is no national exam board. We decide what we want to teach you. We then set the exams, we then mark it. Now, in subjects like psychology and like law, where there are some national regulations for law, do have to kind of, can't just do what you like. In some subjects, like economics, it's a bit more rigid. You'll tend to do the same kind of thing no matter where you go to university. But in geography, what you're taught will depend almost entirely on who happens to be in the place you go to and what they happen to be interested in. They will offer you a choice between doing physical geography and human geography. About half, or just under half, the staff will do physical geography, half will do human geography. But then the kind of thing they do will depend on them. So it's quite important when you're thinking of going to university to have a little look at what they actually do. Don't believe the website. The front of the website will tell you they're brilliant. They rank number one in various ways. They all say this. Get really high assessments. It's a really well-rounded kind of course, and you get lots of exciting field trips because the website is a marketing tool designed to attract you in. What you need to do is to go underneath the website and actually look at what the subjects of the courses are and who's teaching them. And then you need to click on who's teaching them and you get a website for them and you can see what kind of research they do, what they write about. And that's how you can tell what it'll be like if you go. If you're applying to a university which hides that, it means it doesn't want you to know what's underneath the cover. So that's my... I'll talk later on about going to university, but that's a key thing. Particularly for geography, because it is so idiosyncratic. And I'm going to give you an example. I'm going to show you seven maps of the world, which have never been shown anywhere before. So you're the first people who are going to see these, so don't worry if they look a bit weird. They come from a book. I wrote a book with my friend Carl Lee, who's taught A-level geography for over 25 years, I think, and still finds geography interesting, although he gets exasperated at times. And it's a book about how geography can be exciting, how it's gone from being what was a pretty dull subject when I was at school. I had a big thick textbook. In that textbook we were taught where you get copper from, where you get tin from, where you get steel from, where you get iron to make steel from. Almost how you invade these countries to make sure you get it. and we were taught about the ice age that was about to come and how we're going to get much colder. That was my A-level geography, because geography was just coming out of its colonial era. Geography as a subject was invented in this country just over 100 years ago to train young people to become colonial officers to rule and exploit the world. That's the history of our subject. The problem for the subject is, once people have fought and won their independence and you don't have any colonies left, you don't need that kind of geography. When I went to university, I went to Newcastle, my lecturers included colonial officers who'd been sacked in the countries where there were colonial officers, and the British government had to find them a job. And so one job it found for them was being a geography lecturer in places like Newcastle. So it wasn't a particularly right on or exciting discipline. Geographers went up and studied glaciers because they liked going for walks, and they measured them because they wanted to see whether the glaciers were coming down the hills to see whether that new ice age was starting. But after measuring them for several years, they began to notice that they weren't coming down the hills, they're actually retreating and going upwards. And suddenly geographers in the physical side of the subject found themselves on the IPCC board at the forefront of global science, winning peace prizes in 20 years, having got it completely wrong. Things change really fast over what we think goes on. When I was your age, we'd only just accepted that plate tectonics might be true and that these continents might be moving. So a lot of what I'm about to tell you will almost certainly be wrong, because what we believe to be the case is actually changing so quickly. If you look at human geography moves from how you control and exploit people to worrying a bit more about what it's like to be human and what it's like to be in a place, to, now I'd argue, suddenly being very important, because when you ask world leaders, when you ask business people at Davos what matters the most, they put up a little list of the top 30 things, and it starts with climate change, then the next one you get is inequality. That's economic inequality between countries. Who studies economic inequality between countries? It's geographers. Then you get unemployment. If you ask Obama what the most important problem in the world was, he actually said inequality last year over climate change. The Pope came out with a 40,000 word document this year saying we're heading in the wrong direction and global inequality has become so bad that we really, really need to do something about it. I'm going to click on, can you click on the first map for me? Okay, now how many of you have seen a map of the world like this before? Anybody want to put their hand up? Nope. I told you it would be new. Okay, it's a new map of the world. You have seen, okay, similar. What do you think it shows? What do you think you're seeing there?
It could be something like how strong the economy is in that country, and it will increase in size. So I don't know, it seems like Russia is quite big there, so their economy is
big,
stronger.
It's simpler than that, but you've got an idea that size is affecting shape. But I've given you a clue, it's simpler. So that is a map of the world. It has been resized in a particular way.
Go on. Baseball angel?
No, simpler. Really simple, in fact.
Population.
It's population. Yeah, you are just seeing the world shaped by population. So India, over a billion people. China, over a billion people. Africa, just over a billion people. Europe, smaller, but larger than the United States, bigger population. I'm extremely used to these maps, whereas most people aren't, so I kind of take it for granted that they're not that hard to understand. But if you're looking at it thinking, what on earth is that? It just means you're normal. If you're finding it really easy to understand that, keep it quiet. It means you're slightly weird or very good at maths, which is okay, you don't necessarily have to keep it quiet. Any guess at what the lines are? The kind of many lines, the grey lines?
Communication.
Yes, and what forms of communication? What might we be plotting on that map? It's not a trick question. Shall I promise to warn you if I'm going to do a trick question? What's mean?
TNC, straight.
Is it digital communication?
It's digital, so it works. It's submarine cables. That's one thing. So what else have we drawn on there? Any guesses? Loads of them going across the Atlantic. A few going down to Latin America. Quite a lot going over from Japan across the Pacific. Not so many down to, that's New Zealand down there. What could those lines be?
Trade routes.
Yep, and in particular, some ships, but something that's easier to map than ships.
Planes.
Planes. They're aeroplane flights. This is where the world's aeroplanes fly. You can get a very nice screensaver for your phone that shows you all the planes that are currently up in the sky at the moment. And you'll see that the vast majority of the world's planes are flying from rich place to rich place. From Europe to North America to Japan. Very few around poor parts of the world. And finally, that dark line there is showing the maiden voyage of what was the world's largest ship a year ago. And it was a ship which could carry enough containers that if you were to put all those containers, these are 20-foot containers, thank you. If you were to put all those containers on lorries, the convoy of lorries would stretch over 100 miles. We are now these enormous ships carrying huge amounts of goods, mainly from China. Over half the world's containers at any one time are in China, to the Americas and to us. Ship takes just over a month to get to Rotterdam, which is one of our largest container ports and docks, and unloads the containers. What happens to the goods in those containers within about 10 or 15 years? This is everything you buy. It's Christmas. Clothes, washing machine, computers. Yeah. All ends up in landfill. In fact, the vast majority of it ends up in landfill about 10 or 15 years later. Some of it ends up going back in those containers, taken from recycling back to China. But we now have an enormous amount of world trade. You will tend to consume on average 6 times more in weight than your parents did. So what kind of things... Actually, you're the beginning of a cusp. It's starting to change because of electronic devices, so that when it comes to your last few Christmases, if you were game inclined, you probably wanted a different Xbox game and that didn't weigh anything, say. But what are the kind of things that you purchase or you get that your parents didn't get? Or you get more frequently? This is the kind of thing jobs can look at. I'm just trying to show you how it's different from what you've been taught, because what you've been taught is what you have to be taught to do well in your AS or A level, whereas we are allowed to look at anything. Have a think. Do you ever talk to your parent, about what it was like for them? Did they tell you don't know you're born? You ever have that conversation?
Mm-hmm. Same mobile phones.
Yep, there were no mobile phones. Whereas you will have gone through several by now, I suspect.
Yep.
Any of you got your original really cheap one that only does text? Yeah, you've all got a screen that costs a huge amount of money and breaks, designed to shatter so they can sell you another one. Apart from mobile phones, something more obvious that you buy lots more than your parents do. Girls slightly more than boys?
Clothes.
Yeah, if you go to malls or any, you know, you'll see the majority of shops are clothes shops.
Even Mr. Rodriguez is still wearing Lottie's Christmas jumper.
Yeah, he's doing well. So the average item of clothing is now worn about only 12 times in Britain. You may not think that, but just have a look in your wardrobe. So you buy something because you think it looks nice, and then you wear it on Saturday, and you might wear it on a Saturday in 3 weeks time in Saturdays. It's very easy statistic to work out. You can only wear one shirt at a time. You can only wear one skirt at a time. So if we know how many people there are and we know how many clothes are sold, we can work out how much people are not wearing them out today. And that's because clothes have got cheaper because they're mass produced, but it's also because people have got better off so they're able to do it. But also because global trade's increased, so you have these enormous ships, the price of transporting can go down. But it's not very sustainable. So we're beginning to see a turning point. We're seeing it with petrol, with people driving a little bit less, moving around a little less in some ways. Clothes is the last one to actually turn. Should we have another map?
This year might be the first time we're actually producing less CO2 than the year before. That's the first time we've recorded that.
Yeah, it could happen. Okay. What's this a map of then?
Migration.
Yep. For over what time period? You can't see it clearly, so you kind of have
to. Historical.
Yes, it's definitely historical.
Yeah. Thousands of years.
Yeah. It's all migration ever. So it's a go at actually showing. So it begins in East Africa. And if you had very good eyesight, don't worry, you could see the dates at which people actually arrive in Western Europe. Actually, don't get to Madagascar to 1,000 years ago, because I had to go that way round, because if you went that way, you just drowned. There's a terrible... You begin to suddenly realise, when you look at this, how many attempts there must have been for that final little group that did manage to cross over that sea. Got over to the Americas when there was still land, you know, before the sea levels rose, because sea takes up more space when it gets warmer. Shoot all the way down to the Americas, moving about a mile a year. People are very inquisitive. It's dramatic how fast they will go, but they only get to New Zealand about 800 years ago, and they only get to us about, I think it's 10,000 years ago. So it's just an idea of spread. We had no idea of this when I was a child. We had a rough idea it might be happening, but we had no dating of remains and archaeological artefacts to actually know. If you go back 6 generations, so you go back to Charles Darwin, we didn't know we were an animal, that we evolved. So there will be things that we'll be getting wrong now. There were no dates in the middle of India and China because there's huge controversy over what actually happened there. So one way of dealing with huge controversy is you just don't put anything on the map in that place. Do you want to click to another one?
I was going to say, I just found some footprints in the UK, they're obviously outside of Africa.
Yeah.
In Hainsborough.
Found some. People may have come to Britain and then been forced out again. I don't know what the technical term for it is. I will not use naughty language, but the last place you would want to go to is Northwest Europe. Why on earth would human beings go to Northwest Europe? It's cold, it's rainy, it's desolate, but somebody ends up getting pushed here. What most humans did is that they moved around the coasts, around somewhere warmer, and ended up there. Europe was really, really backwards in the world until about 500 years ago. It was a place for losers, if you like to go to. So what happened to change that geographically? A particular event where we suddenly went from being a pretty uncivilised place where barbarians fought each other with mini kingdoms and we couldn't make anything very good, so we got really excited if somebody ever turned up with pepper, because you could put pepper in our meat and it wouldn't taste so rancid. And that was about the most exciting thing that happened in Europe. We couldn't create any decent civilization, so we relied on the Greeks, who were only barely European for our entire history, because we didn't do much. You had civilizations in China, civilizations in Africa, great civilization in India. The Islamic world had invented numbers and, you know, mathematics and so on. We'd done almost nothing. So what happened about 500 years ago? It doesn't relate to this map, which is of something completely different. It's very geographical. It does relate to this map in a way, in that most of this map you wouldn't have seen 500 years ago. How does Europe suddenly become a bit more interesting? The reason you should know this, it's not in your A-level syllabus, it's not in the history syllabus.
Is it like trade and stuff? When
yeah.
They start going out on boats and sailing the world.
It's going out in boats and trade, but a particular...
Is it John Harrison's clock?
That came later. The invention of latitude came later, being able to measure latitude. Why did you need that clock? It's going back earlier.
In 1492.
You guess. In 1492, what happened?
Columbus sank.
Yeah.
The ocean blew.
Yeah. So, a slightly mad man with three absolutely tiny ships sets off. There have been many other voyages like this, they'd all failed. Sets off and discovers a new planet. Right? The new world was just like discovering a new planet. And he was looking for pepper because he didn't want the meat to taste so bad. And you can make a lot of money finding spices. That's why he was trying to find the West Indies for spices. What he found was an entire continent. And what that continent had, above all else of interest to us, was silver. So the Spanish and the Portuguese, first of all, turn up. Mass destruction. 50 million people die. Not because we stabbed them to death with swords, but because we were carrying smallpox and syphilis and numerous other things, which these people who'd arrived in the Americas hadn't evolved against. So more than decimate the population of the Americas, discovered that they're wearing silver and gold, forced them to show us where it comes from, and then send them down mines for their entire lives and their children's lives and their grandchildren's lives to mine the silver out for us so we can bring the silver back. This is pieces of eight in galleons over the Atlantic, first of all to Spain and Portugal and then later to us, so we can take the silver and send it over to China and to India and say, oh look, we've got something now, please we have some more spices. And that's the beginning of Western Europe beginning to become more powerful. It's a geographical story at the start of it. Completely different map, don't go forward yet. We've got to work out with this one. So what is it of? You've had it up for a couple of minutes. I'm testing you, you're the first people who've seen these, and I'm going to have to show these in a lot of talks next year, and I want to know how weird they look.
The only thing I can see is the most expanded parts of the map appear to be isolated places. I'm not sure what connection
is. You're completely right. This is the world where area is proportional to how far away you are from people. So if you want to get away from people, this is the world of wilderness. We're actually getting more wildernesses because the population of the world's moving into cities. Over half the population are in cities now. It'll be three quarters by the time you're my age, probably. It's an incredible change. You know, people migrating into Britain are largely migrating into London. You know, this is the area that's going to grow. Worldwide, London was the biggest city 100 years ago in the world, with a million people. It's now about the 25th biggest city, and rapidly dropping down, which is partly why people are talking about building up in London. Not even to keep its place as 25th rank, it will still fall, but not to plummet like a stone. And all the time people are still coming off farms, off villages, out of really boring, small places. Even in England. Real incentive to get to university isn't you lot, you're in London, it's somewhat interesting, there are jobs you could do here without going to university. But imagine that you were growing up on the north coast of Norfolk. Now, in the north coast of Norfolk, it's nice to go on holiday. We see an incredible rate of university applications from some of these places. Because people get bored and that happens one life. Let's go forward to another map. I've got four to go and I shouldn't go on too long. It's another guessing game. There's a key which gives you a kind of clue. What are the dark areas? What's it showing? It's over population distribution. So underneath you've got the population map. It's not density of population, it's some bit of physical geography I'm showing over the human geography.
Is it oil?
No, it's not oil. It's a resource that matters. It's liquid.
Water.
Water. It's rainfall. So you're seeing the annual rainfall. which you could, you'd be used to on a normal map. Does A-level still include rainfall?
Not the
A-level. Not the A-level, okay, fair enough. Well, that's quite good, it's a bit... So what you're seeing here is where the monsoon hits. But also those areas, Pakistan, Cairo, Palestine, which have got a lack of water, but lots of people. It doesn't matter if you've got a lack of water somewhere, if nobody's living there, that's fine. The problem is if you've got a lot of people somewhere and you don't have much water, you could have problems.
So you've got water stress and water scarcity, don't
you?
Yes, we do.
You do a bit. Yeah. Some of these maps are for physical geographers because they don't like what I do. Let's push forward again. On all? Yeah, click again. There we go. On all these weird maps, you can plot things like earthquakes or volcanoes and so on, and you get a completely different picture. Because again, volcanoes, not that important unless they're near people. Earthquakes. It's the earthquakes near large population centres that are going to affect us the most. So it changes your view of the important things. So one more guessing game. It's going to end very soon, this guessing game. It's getting tedious. It's interesting for me because I honestly don't know, you know how difficult it is. It's pretty difficult. This is a hard one. I promise I'll tell you if it's a trick question. This isn't easy to get right. But it's a bit like water. It's something that matters a lot for our survival.
Oil.
It's not oil.
Energy?
Nope. It's a good guess, because solar.
Food.
It's food, and in particular, it's crops. So it's where we grow the food in the world. Water's tricky. The good news about food is that we have enough of it. And we can almost certainly make more of it, particularly if we stop eating as much meat, so that we can feed a growing population. The brilliant thing about food, unlike water, with water you can have swimming pools, you can waste it. What happens to you if you eat twice as much food as somebody else?
You get fat.
You get fat. This is brilliant. If it wasn't the case that you got fat if you ate more food, the poor world would be absolutely, totally impoverished, because we would be happily eating all their food. As it is, we've got as many people who are overweight as are undernourished in the world. So, I may think in weird ways, but the alternative, you know, if you could do what so many affluent Romans do and have a feast and make yourself sick and then eat again, if that ever became fashionable, again, we'd be in big trouble worldwide.
We could look at life in the marshes next year, and the grand issue seems to be, one of the grand issues, literally, is what I call globesity, and the fact that obesity is no longer a rich nation's problem. It's in the townships of South Africa and in some particular groups of people who happen to be very poor. So, the food supply issues, not necessarily the food security issues, not necessarily enough.
No, it's new. I mean, it's very high in Mexico. It's really recent for Britain. There were almost no obese children before 1992. And then childhood obesity just takes off like this, because the availability of food, and of course people trying to make you eat. I'll talk a little bit, how long have I got?
About 20 minutes.
20 minutes, okay, I can do it. I'll talk to you a bit about inequality later, because most of what I do is look at the richest 25 countries in the world and compare the unequal ones to the more equal ones. And there are various things that go wrong in the unequal ones. One is that the more unequal your rich country is, the fatter you get. So the fattest people on the planet are Americans. The thinnest are Japanese. It's not something genetic. It's that food advertising is forced down Americans' throats. We get twice as much advertising as most people in Europe. We are fatter than most people in Europe. It's happened fast. And it's quite hard to control. Then you get the upper middle class making their kids thinner, so controlling their diet. You'll get some of your parents having done this endlessly to you, and have adapted very quickly. Human beings vary massively individually in our ability to get fat. I can say this as a fatter than average person. We have genetic differences that have been discovered in us individually, which we don't pass on. So some of you, if you're smug, finny people, you may be able to eat quite a lot and you don't get fatter, you've got high metabolism. Other people like me, just give me a crisp and it goes on my waistline. The genetic advantage of this is that when the next famine hits, I'm afraid you skinny lot have had it, you're going to die. But in the normal scope of things, it's better to have skinnier people because people like me die more often of heart attacks. Now, we evolved to have this variation in our ability to absorb food. Geographers get to look at genetics as well. It all works fairly fine until you suddenly get an overabundance of food. And then the people like me, who still hope one day there will be that famine, just so that we can prove you wrong. But the people like me, you just have to change your behaviour against the food industry desperately trying to get you to buy more. Selling sugar because it's addictive, and opposing any sugar taxes and so on. Let's go forward. Okay.
There you go.
No, one back. Back one. Can't miss that one out. That's my favourite one. You'll have seen this one on the normal map before. But again, another guess. Anybody want to guess what the dark areas are? Now remember, you're looking at a population map here, so there are people everywhere. And they're exactly the same density of people everywhere, because we've stretched it if there are lots of people.
They're
not wearing away. They will be people who've got more often likely to have pipe water and pipe sewage. That's true, but that's not what it's showing.
Urban.
It is urban areas, but it's particular urban areas.
Megacity.
They tend to be megacities, but if you look in Britain, you know, Manchester, if you've got Bury, you can see Manchester there and Bristol. They're not megacities. This picture was taken by satellite. So it's a very famous satellite image that we've just stretched onto a new projection.
Is it like use of electricity or something?
Yeah, really close. So how can you tell use of electricity by satellite?
Lights.
Lights, yeah. That's it. It's the Earth at night. So it's a fairly famous, I should show you the original image, but you probably have seen it. It's a composite picture where many satellite pictures at night on cloudless skies have been put together to show what the planet looks like if you could fly over it all. Now when you normally see that picture, you think it's a picture about where people are, which it largely is on a normal map because the Sahara is all black. So, but here, people are everywhere. So there's only two possible reasons for an area being white. One reason is that they have no electricity or very little electricity. The other reason is that they've decided not to use electricity to power street lights, which are very inefficient and shine light up so that you can draw a picture from the sky. So it's really a picture of light pollution. The highest pollution in the world 10 years ago was Tokyo. Tokyo has now cut back on the amount of light pollution, because Tokyo had to shut down all the nuclear power stations after the tsunami, had to cut its electricity use by a quarter. It's possible to do that, you don't have so many neon signs. And then Cairo has been increasing its use of electricity recently, so you see a change. But if you like, this is a map of energy we create that we waste, because you can't see it, there are better ways. We get LED streetlights now that are no good for taking satellite pictures. Almost at the end, I think this is the last map. There we go. Okay, so this is the population map with the oceans taken out of it. Apart from it looking a bit weird and really showing that up there, my glasses will reach far enough, it won't. You may be able to see the strange shape of Britain on the far northwest side. We're 1% of the world's adults. You are 0.5% of the world's children. We are rapidly shrinking in population terms. Luckily, we have immigration. Otherwise, we'd disappear. Apart from it sort of being a strange image, could you actually use that map to drive a car with? If we zoomed in on it, could you? This is a very techie question. If we took that part, which is Britain, and we zoomed in on London, Could you draw the roads on this map and actually drive on it?
Would they be stretched a bit?
They would be stretched a little bit. Do you know of a map of London that's stretched a little bit that you used to get around London?
Tube
map. Would you be able to recognise the actual real map of the tube? Or have you become so used to the stretch one you think it's real? The very faint lines there are lines of latitude and longitude. And they curve on this map, but they all actually still meet at 90 degrees. Slightly weird. So you could draw a road map of the world on this. And if you zoom down, it would look like a normal map. The map here would look just like a normal map. You know, you've got all these houses around here, remarkably similar, 3 or 4 bed semis. Like, the population density is very, very even. At night, the land of this school would shrink, and this school would disappear on the map. And then in the day, when you come in, it'll get bigger and bigger and bigger, so that it had a population size of 1,400 pupils and an extra 200 or 300 staff. The houses would shrink a little bit in size because people are going into work. It's actually a map that moves. I don't know if that's just in my head and you're thinking, what has he been taking? What I'm trying to get over to you is the idea that I get paid to do this. Right? It is quite interesting. When you go to university, it's not quite as exciting as this because they give you lots of exams in the first year and they do kind of have a syllabus. But if you do another degree, if you do a PhD and you become a doctor in this and you become a researcher, the point of research is you're allowed to sort of decide what you want to do. You've got to convince somebody to fund it. It's not always easy. But it is very different. Inequality. Shall I just tell you something about inequality? Because that's the last thing I'd like to talk about. Haven't got any more maps of it, so we'll just stop on that map. Let's just tell you some stats. I want to know your reactions to it, okay? If you look at Britain, 2 years ago, in 2014, the combined wealth of the 1,000 richest people in this country had risen to 519 billion. That was 55% more than it had been 4 years ago. That increase, if you hadn't given it to the 1,000 richest families in Britain, but just spread it out, would be an extra £6,000 for every family in the country. In effect, the 1,000 richest countries, 1,000 richest families have taken that £6,000 for themselves. By 2015, the wealth had reached 547 billion. Might be a meaningless number to you, that's another £28 billion for those 1,000 families. Twice what they took in 2019. So the very richest, over half of whom live in London, have doubled their wealth. It's not as dramatic as in the States. Last week in the States, the 400 richest families in the States owned more wealth than 36 million median wealth families did, average US families. So that's each one of those 400 families had the same wealth as 90,000 average US families, not poor ones. Globally, the best off 1% in the world now have over half of all the world's wealth. It has been rising a lot recently, but last time it was this high was 1913, and then it had dropped. I've got a quote from the director of Oxfam, who says, "Are we really happy to live in a world where the top 1% own half the wealth and the poorest half own just 1%? Something quite extraordinary has been happening in the last sort of 30 years. It accelerated after 2010-9. Is your reactions to this... Is your reaction to this simply to say that's what life is like now? How aware are you of it? There has never been a generation of young people who have gone from being 10 and 11 and 12 years old to being your age at a period when the very richest in the world have taken so much. But that's your experience. even that period before 1913, it was much slower, the rise of the take of the best of. How, what is your reaction to it? I'm just intrigued about global inequalities increasing this much for the very wealthy, about Britain becoming so unequal, probably going to be the most unequal country in the rich world soon. Does it mean that London just becomes a land of opportunity because there are more and more people here with a lot of money, so they're going to create things that happen? I don't know. That's the thing I wanted to end on. And it's genuine interest in... It's not normal to me, because when I was your age, the UK was the second most equal large country in Europe. Only Sweden was more equal than we were. The best off 1% only took about 6 times average income. Top bankers would be paid about £120,000-£130,000 rather than £1 million. You could go to the local school. The normal thing for most people was to go to the nearest school. There were no school league tables, so you wouldn't think of going to the school that wasn't nearest. You could buy a house when you're 25 if you had an average job and start a family. That happened when I was young. All of that's gone, so it seems to me odd it's gone, but if you never saw a world like this that I saw, maybe it's just normal to have billionaires and people with really expensive cars in the middle of your town. And I don't know, what's the average house price around here?
900,000.
900 for one of those big semis. Yeah, near the tube station.
Between 900,000
and 1.2. Okay, I'll end with one stat and then please tell me your reaction. Supposing you make it into the 1%. Now, to get into the best of 1%, go to university, could be you. Okay, you go and do law. You specialise in corporate law. Then you get a job in Canary Wharf as a corporate lawyer. This is in about 7 or 8 or 9 years' time. And you're fairly good, they keep you on for 2 or 3 years, and they pay you £160,000. Right, you're in the 1%. Somebody will loan you, say about 4 or 5 times that as a mortgage. So work out what 4 or 5 times 160,000 is.
800,000.
Yeah. You, the potential to about you, these child from this school who's gone and done the best in terms of income could not afford to live in this area. That just seems remarkable to me. But is it just normal to you? And am I really getting really old? This kind of worries me. But what do you think is going to happen?
To us it doesn't seem as different, because we don't know any better or any different to that, because for us it's always been like that, really.
Yeah.
Having people who are much more richer than the ones who are really poor.
It's quite common.
I think that it's not actually that common. I think that it's spiralling out of control. If I go off to university, what in London, I don't think I can come back and afford to own a house.
Yeah.
I don't see myself being able to afford a house in the area that I've grown up in, and this being normal for that.
I would suggest that you won't be able to buy a house full stop.
Yeah. Mm.
None of them can. And it's a really depressing thing to have to say. If it continues like this, and I'm sorry to, I grew up in the same time frame as Dundee, and like I remember, you could buy your house at 22, 23, set a family.
Yeah.
Unless you're on that ladder now, it's a really depressing
thing. It seems depressing, but one advantage of youth is you'll tend to be more optimistic than we are, because we're at the bottom of what's called the optimism curve. Yeah. It does get better when we get 70s, 80s and 90s, hopefully. Go on.
I think it's just become commonplace. I mean, you hear our generation say, I'm sure our parents and teachers as well, they're always talking about how the price of housing has gone up, especially in London. And it's something that I don't think many of us have paid that much attention to it, but it's something that we've heard in the background and we're aware of.
Yeah.
But it's just common. We all accept it. We all know that it's something that's true.
Yeah.
I think too, it's a ridiculous sense of guilt. I mean, I feel quite guilty, but
that I bought a house for £110,000 that I've lived in for 25 years, and it's now worth four times as much what I paid for it. And when I paid for it, I took out a £75,000 mortgage, and my parents told me, I must be mad buying that amount of money. I must be starving mad, because they bought houses for £32,000, and my grandparents bought houses for £2,000, and my grandfather built houses for £80 each, which, I mean, we're small business, one of my friends bought for £380,000. And I just feel, I haven't done anything about it. I just made it.
You could build a nice house now for £100,000, but not paying builders London wages, but you can actually build a very nice house for £100,000, it's the land. I'll just tell you two things to make you optimistic about this, maybe, and then end. One is that almost all of you are going to take out student loans if you go to university. Those loans you will have to repay in proportion to what you earn. So if you earn an average salary, you'll be repaying £56,000 or something. If you do slightly better, that's you again, you'll be paying £100,000 back. That's your entire generation, apart from the very few rich kids whose mum and dad pays that up front. Your entire generation is going to have this debt, and then people like me are going to try and sell our houses to you at a point where you won't be able to pay the prices that we want for them. And that's kind of... You can see that happening. The other thing to do with the 1.2 million, when a house costs £1 million, for a landlord, about the most they can rent it out for most people in London, is about £20,000 a year. Still a lot of money to hand over, £20,000 a year. £20,000 a year on a £1 million investment is only a 2% return. Nobody in their right mind invests money for a 2% return. So the landlords are partly buying these houses because they think they're going to carry on going up in value. But who the hell's going to buy them? And if you're not going to be able to afford to pay rent because you're not going to be paid that much, it can't. You know, you might just be lucky. People a few years older than you, I think, are going to be very unlucky. But there's going to be one generation where this will have to sort itself out for it, because you can't carry on pushing its way. Because it won't just be that you can't buy a home to start a family, it'll be that you can't rent a home to start a family. And then what does a generation do? Do you all sit back and go, well, that's okay, we won't have children. Or you might just do something else about it. Thank you very much.
So, with the greatest respect,
yeah.
I also have the greatest respect to screen or something.
Yeah.
I just think the London property market at the moment is like a sink for money coming in from abroad, where investment abroad is really difficult, but property prices in London are relatively stable and going up. I look at recent developments going on in even around some Greenwich and places like that, where I know that new builds are being bought up by speculators who are pricing local people out of the housing market, even in
Greenwich. And Battersea and so on.
Yeah.
At the moment, everything came together to cause the London house price bubble. So one thing that happened is that the Americans demanded the Swiss banking authorities open up the bank accounts 2 years ago. So they opened up the bank accounts to the Americans to see if Americans were hiding their money from America, and they discovered they were empty because they bought property in London. Singapore doesn't let Chinese people buy in Singapore because it's way back, they buy flats and leave them empty. So the Chinese jumped over. There's a housing crash in China, so Chinese investors stopped buying in China, they bought here. Then we get a European-wide crash, which results in mass unemployment in Europe, 25 million unemployed young people in Europe. Where the hell do you go? You go to where you speak your second language. So we get this huge influx of young, highly skilled Europeans. Everything came together to push house prices up. But those investors who are buying in London, at some point, have to work out. It's like the tulip bulb, you know, the first speculative bubble. At some point you work out, this £30 million flat isn't worth £30 million, even if it was painted in gold. The gold wouldn't be worth £30 million. I think it has to happen at some point. All the investors get scared because the Labour Party go and elect somebody who you never know might end up in power. And what's he going to do? He's going to tax their property, isn't he? So what kind of an investment is it if you can't physically move it and somebody's just elected a leader of a party and a shadow chancellor who believes in a land value tax? You might think they've got no chance, but they've got that far. It would make me worry about my investment. Yeah, the longer they carry on, if they do okay in that Oldham by-election, how safe is my money in London? There were all these kind of things going on. The last big city in the world to see this was Tokyo. By 1989 in Tokyo, the Tokyo Imperial Palace grounds were worth more than the whole of California. It had got that ridiculous. House prices just went up and up and up. And then, the year after, they crashed and they halved in value. And they've never recovered since. That has happened before. It's not inevitable, but it has to feel inevitable for speculators to carry on buying at these prices. But you can help bring the crash about just by quietly saying, is it worth that much? Are you sure it's worth that much? At what point do you have to actually say, this thing only costs £100,000 to build, you're selling it me for £1 million. How valuable is that land? Is the land only valuable because you've got flats and houses that are increasingly empty in the middle of London that increases the price out here? What would happen if we let people live in Kensington again, where the population's actually dropping in Kensington? What would happen if we started to tax empty flats if they're empty, so that Chinese investors tried to get some tenants in? That should reduce demand. But none of this will happen if people just sit back and say, oh, just do it to me, I don't mind you exploiting me completely. It does require, you know, some degree of anger about it. But because it's affecting such a large swathe of society, you've got to be really, really, like I gave you this example of a hypothetical you doing really well. You know, if even you don't do well out of this, if 99.5% of people are not doing well out of this, why are people going to accept it? And I think they're only accepting it because it's such a recent development that it's become this bad this quickly. Thank you very much.
Thank you.